by. Tony, good morning.
Steve, I missed most of the show this morning. I've been running errands, and Casey timed it perfect by calling me just now.
Perfect.
Just
that's good.
My errands.
Nice. We got about 15 minutes or so with you, and I don't know if you were able to, hear Rich Migliore at all on Tuesday?
No. You know what? I've been going out to the track, and I wound up getting on horses and driving back. I never listened.
No problem. No problem. More of the crop stuff.
I bet he had a good take on it. I mean, here's a guy that rode thousands of winners, been on thousands and thousands of horses, and is in a position right now that he can get the media attention about this whole whip fiasco that everybody's going to be dealing with. At this particular time, Pennsylvania hasn't moved forward, and I think maybe they're for once showing some good judgment and waiting to see the outcome of California and see what comes of that situation, because there's a lot of negative feedback when it comes to the situation out in California, right down to the betting public isn't handling it well. And, you know, everybody says, well, we have to really make amends with the fan base, and we have to be thinking about the fans of this sport. Well, you know what? The people that knock this sport are not fans of the sport, and that's the people that are putting pressure on everybody to do something. The fan base doesn't have to be pacified, and we don't have to pass these BS type of profile rules, you know, that just pacify them. The fan base doesn't need to be pacified, and let's not step on the fan base's toes, the real booster of horse racing, by doing something that amends the public image, you know, or gives the public a positive image of the sport. Because the people that need to be given a positive image are not our supporters. They're not people that want to see racing thrive. PETA doesn't want to see racing thrive. Knockers of the sport don't want to see racing thrive. And my whole thing is, we're stepping on the toes of the true fan of the sport by doing things to pacify these knockers. The hell with these knockers.
I kind of tore off in that direction in the last hour myself, and I've tried to maintain an even strain on this topic, but I completely agree. You're bending over backwards, and most importantly, and California has been the most glaring spot when it comes to this already, because it's instantly impacted the quality of the racing or the quality of the performances when it comes to the horse player. And it's the players, not just the players, but the connections too, the owners, the jocks, and the trainers. If a horse is not being motivated in late stages and being kept to task, and that, you know, those kinds of elements, there's plenty of horses who respond to urging. And I guess I understand to some degree, saying, well, you can get as much done with the legs and hands and arms. You can urge a horse that way, and that sometimes is as productive or more productive than the crop. Okay. And then there's the occasions when it's not more effective than the crop. Tony, and you and Mike Smith and John Velasquez and Mig, you guys have competed 150,000 times, collectively, and you know the difference, and nobody seems to give the time of day to, the people that are, aboard the horse. That's maddening in its own right.
Yeah, I mean, nobody comes to the jockeys and say, we want you to be part of the board that determines these new rules with the whip. You know, the biggest thing they should do with the whip is look at the whip and adopt the whip that I really have a lot of respect for, and it's that Gentle Touch 360 that Dominguez yep. came up with. I love that whip. It makes a lot of noise. It's a great instrument of encouragement. It's the horse can see it real good, and it gives them just enough touch when you use it that they, because of the sound it makes, they respond to it. They feel what? I could hit you with it, Steve. I told you that before, and you would look at me like, say, when are you going to hit me? You know, it doesn't create discomfort, but it makes a lot of noise, and it does touch them where they do, you know, you can touch a horse's hide by their belly, and you ever go walk up real quick and touch one and how they'll flinch, their whole hide will flinch, you know, and that's just you touching them with your finger, but it's a good instrument. It really should be adopted. And the way they're going about this whole thing right now, like I said, they're pacifying the wrong people. You know, they're pacifying, what, the knockers? Well, the knockers are going to exist, and they're going to stay knockers. You're never going to satisfy them. You know, you don't step on the toes of the true fan of this sport. It just really irks me.
Well, the players. I mean, there's nobody being injured worse than the horse players. They're the ones that, you know, are sitting there watching as their horses are hand ridden and with urging, might have won or might have had a better placing, and those are the people that are being, you know, really injured, and it's such an unproductive circle of events here.
Right, and you know what else, Steve? In the history of racing, there's been many a time a jock was fined because he didn't ride his horse out, or why did you stand up before wire? Why didn't you reach down? And I see fines over the years that jocks, you know, did not persevere. You know, you could have done a better job finishing on this horse, and you got fined, and nobody complained about it. You know, you thought, you know what? Maybe it wasn't my day. Maybe I could have done a better job. This is inviting you to not do a good job. Oh, I hit him six times. He was getting out. I couldn't cock my stick and tap him in the nose to keep him in. You know, you got to hit underhanded because you're not allowed to cock your stick. You know what? When you don't cock your stick, it's a difference in sensation and feel for switching sticks. You know, usually a jock switches sticks from right to left. It's cocked. It's not uncocked, and you're not pulling it all the way through. You're taking the handle with one hand, the other hand grabbing the above it, pulling it out. You're not pulling the whole stick out. The stick is cocked. They're saying you can't cock the stick. You can't hit him more than six times. I mean, come on, put somebody on this board that makes these decisions and that writes these ridiculous rules, that sat on a racehorse, that did more than just come to work maybe and, maybe just take entries and watch races. Or some of them never even took entries and watched races. They just come up with this thing because it's their perception. And their perception is considered to them as being qualified. Well, you're not qualified. You're not qualified till you sit on a horse and you've encouraged him and you've handled him and you've guided him and you've encouraged him to go on and do his best. You know, I rode horses. I'll never forget a horse I used to ride for J.J. Gracie. Had his number taken down a few times, not with me on him. But he would get to the lead and he'd make a left, he'd make a right, he'd try to prop. If you didn't have a stick on him to encourage him and tell him, no, you might have made the lead, but the race ain't over. A horse's name was Reliable Jeff. He was a real card. You know, you better cock your stick. You better reach down and crack him, and you better let him know the race ain't over just because he got his head in front. And he had been taken down with riders that didn't respond quickly enough on him. There's been a ton of horses that I've ridden that you have to use it to keep their mind and their attentive. You have to make them stay attentive, you know. And some horses, like you said, they're good horses. They're encouraged with the stick. And then the horse that shows you he isn't, though you reach and hit him, he pins his ears, you know, okay, I'll utilize the stick sparingly or won't even use it. You know, the one thing that has been done in other states when it comes to jockeys utilizing their stick in an unprofessional way, in an inhumane way, that you can warn, fine, suspend. And you know what else they've done? they've actually taken the stick away from a rider for, like, say, 3 racing days. You can't carry a stick. And you know what?
Interesting.
That'll get his attention because people know it's advertised. Listen, this jock's riding your horse today. He can't carry a stick. Well, I don't want him on my horse. You know, that's come about. Well, when I entered the horse, I didn't know that. He's not allowed to carry a stick. Oh, no, I'll put somebody else on him. But that made an impression on the jock when he lost business. It wasn't a suspension. It was just you don't carry a stick for 3 days. And that's been done. I believe it even was done in New England when racing was thriving in New England. But let's not step on the betting public's toes. And I know even in this day and age and over the years that I've ridden, when they had big public attendance, you'd come back and you did your best on a horse, reached down and cracked him, pushed on him, threw another cross, reached down and cracked him, pushed on him, and you got beat a nose or a head, and the spectator would be saying, what the hell, you fell asleep on that son of a gun, you know, and you got reamed out. And that was without any restrictions. They're placing these restrictions on you, and they're planting a dangerous seed of thought in a jockey's mind where he stops dealing with his instinctual reaction to what a horse is doing because he's got this negative seed of thought that the stick, I can't use it. I can't use it. Somebody's going to wind up getting hurt, and who's going to be liable for it? Is it going to be these idiots that made this no stick rule or this stick rules? You know, who's going to be liable? Maybe that'll get their attention. If somebody, there's a lawsuit that comes about because of this, because some jock got hurt because you planted a negative seed of thought in his mind and he didn't deal with riding this individual horse instinctually. He didn't do what he knew was right with the stick because you've got him jumping through hoops and scared to use it.
Tony, you've said one thing. Before we go, I got to get Steve Haskin in for a appreciation of Tisnow and his career. But you said one thing about persevering. And, you know, this is a topic earlier with Dick. We were talking some of the international standard approaches. And one thing that is done that we could use more of is the stewards asking. And it doesn't have to include, you know, necessarily, being a penalties and so forth, but, just to have the discussion points. But the calling jocks in and asking about either failure to persevere or a surprising change of tactics that leave players mystified. Was it a trainer instruction? Did you consciously think that I don't want to go to the lead with this horse? There's too much speed. And in your career, how much evolution has there been in those arenas? I mean, how often were you called in and asked, you know, why didn't you finish, or, you know, what about this extreme change in tactic?
You know what? Years ago, there was probably more communication with jockeys and stewards, you know, and that was prior to when appeals and everything got popular and commissions overturned stewards' decisions. There was good, I'll never forget, it's funny you say how much communication I've had. There was one year I was riding a horse in Maryland called Sir Jig, and he was a fast horse that would run off in the early stages of the race, and there's another horse I'm going to tell you about called Road of Roses. And the stewards called me in, and I happened to win on him this day, but leaving the gate, I used to tell the man, put a citation bit, put an overcheck bit on this horse. So I can't, he runs himself into the ground, I can't get him back. So he never put an overcheck on him. I think it was Richard Zimmer was the trainer at the time, a castaway from Alan Jurgens. And I left the gate, I said, I'm going to get this son of a gun back today. I jerked him back, I made him do everything, but he put his head straight in the air and I got him back. I got him back. Here I come running down the stretch, and I win the race. The stewards called me in right after the race. This is in Maryland. You know, qualified stewards. They said, what the hell were you doing leaving the gate? I says, I asked the man to put a citation bid on him. He didn't. I had to get this horse back. He's been going to the lead and stopping, and he's never going to win that way. Well, they said to me, if you didn't win this race, we were going to call you in, and there was going to be a problem with your performance. I says, no problem, Judge. I want it, so there's no problem. But they said, yeah, we haven't seen that happen before where you jerk a horse's head off that much and get him back and still win it. Usually it's some other reason. You know, he's either sore, you didn't want to let him run for some reason. But we were going to call you in. Lucky you win it. I rode another horse called Road of Roses. Same similar situation. You know, got her back, here she comes running, and she was also a flipper in the gate, so she would make you sit tight and sit chilly. I got her back, and Ed Payne, he was a trainer for Shinrohn Farm at the time, and Jack Vanberg sent him to Merlin with some horses. And I got her back, and here she come running. She paid $97. And by that time, the stewards knew what I was. They said, oh, we saw that exhibition one other time. You know, it must work. I said, well, I'm known as a speed rider, but every once in a while I get them back. They said, well, you should try to do it a little more smoothly than that. I said, sometimes some horses don't allow you to get them back smoothly. You got to impress upon them. They're not going to the lead. But both the horses I brought to mind when you were saying that were Sir Jig and Road of Roses. And we lit the board up those days.
That
was good communication with Stewart.
Well, and it's very healthy, and it also demonstrates to the riding colony that the stewards are watching, that they're paying attention, and so even if there isn't a set of prescribed penalties, it sends a potentially impactful message to the room that you can't, you know. You can't do whatever you want out there, and there has to be some accountability. And that, you know, on the flip side of this, if you did do this, it might make its way into reports, and the betting public can feel better too that these races are being watched. And you know, even if it's just verbal warnings and some sort of a, you know, some sort of a declaration from the stewards that, you know, we see this and it's problematic and et cetera, you know?
Yeah, good communication. And it also sends a message, as you said, yeah, we're watching you. Make sure you do things right. Make sure you persevere. We're not up here just making believe we're monitoring the races of stewards. We are monitoring them. But the one thing I keep getting back to, the guys that are not the fans, they're not fans. The people that are knockers of the sport, you're not going to make them fans. You know, chances are they've already formulated their opinion. But in the process of putting these rules forward, let's not step on the betting public's toes. Let's make sure we take care of them. They're the fans of the sport, not PETA, not these knockers. You're not going to change their mentality and what they think of the sport. So let's not do things to pacify them. Let's make sure we do what's good for the betting public, the true fans of the sport.
Exactly. Exactly. We're paying the freight. Well, Tony, I had a couple other things, but I'll save it for a fuller conversation when we talk next.
Sounds good. I didn't go out this morning because Vega walked everything, but I breezed one yesterday. We were halfway to the track, and he says, oh, I thought this horse was just galloping. You better take him back to the barn. He breezes 5/8 a mile. You're only been on 3 or 4 horses. I says, I'm fit. I breezed him 5/8 a mile, went 101, and I looked just like the jockey I used to look like.
I'd love it.
I'm enjoying getting on horses.
You know what this means. If Tony's going to start getting on him, that means there's going to be that magical moment when he says, I think I could ride one in the afternoon if you want to name me.
Yeah, 70-year-old. I want to be 70 and win a race. That'll probably be one of the oldest riders to win a race in North America. So maybe I'll be one of the oldest when I turn 70.
Unbelievable. So crazed.
Not that far away, Steve.
Well, I don't know if this is such a great plan, but that's pretty funny. Tony Black, everybody, always spectacular. Tony, thanks.
Take care, Steve. Keep up the good work, and tell Haskins I love anything he writes and I read. Take care, Steve.
Thanks, Tony.
Steve, take care. Bye.
Tony Black, everybody, and more, you know, a little bit more about the, you know, the situation with the stick, but he planted that seed in my mind about, you know, asking about the change of tactics. I mean, we've had this conversation, well, with Pat Cummings. This has come up. I mean, and you know, notably, well, and with Dick too. This has come up with the Hong Kong riders. Steve Haskins standing by, and Steve, like so many others, who was tuned in closely during Tisnow's tremendous back-to-back classic wins. The news yesterday that Tisnow pensioned. I'm not sure. Is that from Steve? There we go. Is that better? Steve, good morning. All right. I think Casey may have taken him off. Would you take him off the air? Yeah, that was, or did you lose him?
I'm here.
You are here. Okay, much better. All right, there was crazy interference.
I just want to know if you have settled down from your earlier tirade.
I don't know. I'm not. I wouldn't call it a tirade either.
Speaking of Tisnow, by the way, if you get a chance, by the way, ask Chris McCarron if he would have won the second classic if he didn't hit Tisnow left-handed. Because he didn't like hitting Tisnow, but the horse was going absolutely nowhere, and he just out of desperation said, "Well, I have nothing to lose," and he just gave him one big shot left-handed, and he surged and found a whole nother gear and stuck his nose in front, and that's what won him the race. That left-handed whip. You can ask McCarron about it.
You bring that up. That is a viable course of query with veteran riders, not just veteran riders, but really anybody. Well, we part of the whole dialogue this summer or this fall with Authentic was this, you know, the strategy involved with hitting him left-handed and motivating him and the, you know, the nuance to that. So I this is just a crazed course of action, seemingly. Let's incorporate all the elements of the Tisnow story, Steve, because when the news spread yesterday, this is really a horse that seems to be a touchstone for a lot of people, the back-to-back classics, and of course the incredible
backdrop,
right, and the whole scenario of 2001.
Yeah, I mean he totally transcended racing. I mean, especially with the second classic. Going back on his career, I got to get everything straight in my mind because I've got so much stuff on him. But I don't think a lot of people don't realize this, but when he won his first classic, by the way, people don't realize the year before his half brother finished second in the classic, Bud Royale. So I mean that dam, you know, as obscure as she was, you know, California breds, and no California bred had ever won the Breeders' Cup Classic. She came about a length short of winning three straight Breeders' Cup Classics,
which would have sort of had a little bit of a tie with the breed.
Oh, you mean Rags to Riches?
With Rags to Riches and right and the whole honor. Oh my God! Just for Honor. Oh my God. Yeah, I mean
Steve.
I know, but I had forgotten about Bud Royal the year before.
Yeah. Well, the thing is about, you know, with Tisnow, you know, he's got the reputation of being such a tough horse and, you know, a fighter, and he wouldn't let anybody pass him. Sometimes that goes way, way back that you don't realize. I mean, when he was born at Harris Farms in California. And he weighed 144 pounds as a foal, which is, like, massive. I mean, he's huge. So what they did at the farm is that they put him with a group of other young horses who had played particularly hard. I mean, they were pretty rough on each other, and he put him in there to teach him not to be bullied. And he would go out there, and all these horses would take turns beating up on each other and bullying each other. And he got used to it, you know. And so he knew how to play rough. Let's put it that way. And when he in that first, you know, people always talk about the second classic. The first classic was pretty remarkable itself, especially they did something that they had never done before in that classic. NBC. Instead of having the usual stretch shot in the camera, they had the stretch shot on the side, and the camera followed the horses from the side. And you could really, really see. I mean, it was a perfect camera angle to see this race, because you could see exactly how close Giant's Causeway got to him and how he just wouldn't. And Giant's Causeway was the Tiznow of Europe. Nobody could pass him. It all depended on which horse was in front. Giant's Causeway had won 5 straight Group 1 races, and his biggest margin of victory was 3/4 of a length. It was all from a mile to a mile and a quarter. I think he ran once in a mile and 5/16, but you just couldn't get by him. In fact, one of the horses that tried twice, who actually headed him, and he came back to beat him, was Calanisi, who wound up winning the Breeders' Cup the Breeders' Cup Turf that first year. But that was amazing. Nobody really knew that much about, you know, Aidan O'Brien then coming as an international trainer. He knew nothing about the Breeders' Cup, about nothing. In fact, he had Giant's Causeway when he went out to the track. Wayne Lucas took him out to the track because Aidan O'Brien didn't know what to do. He didn't know what the protocol was or anything like that. So Lucas was the one who took him out because Lucas had trained some Coolmore horses. But that was an incredible stretch run. And, you know, Tiznow had already shown in the race before when he won the Goodwood how tough he was when he just wouldn't let Captain Steve go by him. And he had set a track record at the Louisiana Downs in the Super Derby. I mean, he was really getting good at the time. And I remember watching the winner's circle, you know, when Cecilia Straub Rubens, who owned the horse with Michael Cooper, she was almost ready to celebrate her 84th birthday. And they had been in the game. They had been partners for like over 20 years, and they had nothing but cheap horses, just cheap claimers. And this was like the first good horse that they had, because they didn't have Bud Royale. There was a guy named Jeffrey Sangara who had that horse. But they gave the horse to Jay Robbins, and he had his antics and everything like that. But when he right after he won the Breeders' Cup, the first Breeders' Cup, 3 days later, Cecilia Straub Rubens died. 3 days later, you know, you've seen her winner's circle on a Saturday, and Tuesday she dies. Mm. She was about to go into surgery. You know, she had cancer, and she really hadn't told anybody about it. You know, if you see her in the winner's circle, you know, she's all smiles and everything, and she's enjoying it, and everybody's happy. And nobody really knew, but she was going to surgery. And you know, she knew it was going to be touch and go. And Jay Robbins' wife Sandy had come to visit her right before the surgery. And the last thing she ever said when she told Sandy, she said the last thing she told her, she says, "Tell Jay to take good care of my boy." Like she knew she was not going to see him anymore. And you know, I mean, something like that. You know, it was just so touching. And then she dies. And you know, Michael Cooper was intent on getting this horse back to the Breeders' Cup for her. So, like you had mentioned before, he had problems. He started out good. He won the San Anita Handicap. He won it by like 5.5 lengths, and looked like he was going to have a tremendous year. And afterwards, all of a sudden, everything changed. He had a workout with McCarran up, and after, you know, they took the saddle off, and he just stood there and wouldn't walk. And, you know, Robbins knew something was wrong. And he thought maybe he had tied up. And they took him back, and he couldn't jog. And he was off. You know, he was off in his hind. So they called in Dr. Rick Arthur, you know, who everybody knows now. He's called in. They did a nucleus scan on the horse. And it wound up that he had one of his vertebrae had a lot of heat in it. And he had all kinds of muscular problems, and he was an absolute mess. So Jay called his father, you know, Jack, who was like, he was retired, but he was like one of the top veterinarians in the sport. And he called him in to examine the horse. And they didn't know if he was ever going to run again. And, you know, because Jack Robbins said, like, oh, my God. He said, I don't think this horse is going to ever run again. He was so totally off behind that they were convinced. And they put him on a muscle relaxant and, you know, all kinds of, gave him time off and rest. And hopefully he would come back. And he just wouldn't show any progress. So I remember they put poultice on his back and hot packs on it, you know, like, well, you know, like a human being would do. And, you know, they walked him a lot. And he started to show some kind of improvement, you know, and he started galloping him. And Jack told his son, he said, I don't know, why don't you just retire him? You know, but, you know, Michael Cooper said that he was still thinking of, you know, Cecilia, and he wanted to show the world, you know, what Tiz now could do and try to do something that no horse had ever done. So they kept persevering, you know, with the back and back. And finally, it started to come around. And the thing is that when they brought him back, he just wasn't the same horse. You know, they brought him to Belmont for the Woodward, and he gets beat. And he just looked lethargic. He gets beat by Frankel's horse, Lido Palace. And that Tuesday after that weekend is when 9/11 happened. And I remember the following Saturday, I drove to Belmont Park just to see how Belmont was going to handle the whole situation. And I remember driving over the Verrazano Bridge. You look out and you can see the smoldering ashes from the city. And it was like surreal driving over the Verrazano. And it just looked so weird because it was a beautiful day. And you could see the Statue of Liberty. And it was like glistening in the sun. I always remember that green was just glistening. And then you look and you see all that smoke coming up and you realize what's going on there and what had happened there. So anyway, I went there and I stopped over at Shug's barn first, because that's the first barn as you drive in. I could barely get in. I mean, you know, they wouldn't even let me in because I showed him my media pass. And he said, I remember the security guy says, that and the box of Cracker Jacks will get you. It basically was telling me the media pins are worthless. So anyway, I managed to get in. I went to Church Bun, and who's walking in the shed row is Tiz now. And I remember talking to his exercise rider, Raphael, and he was stuck there. They wouldn't let him go home. He couldn't, you know, there was no flights going in or out.
Sure.
And, yeah, so, you know, he was stuck at Church Barn. So finally, they, you know, several days later, you know, they were able to fly him out again. Then he ran in the Goodwood Stakes. He gets beat by some like 80-1 shot or something like that. He said, "This horse is just not the same at all." But they're still going to, you know, try the Breeders' Cup. But what happened is that they had put him on tranquilizers, you know, to make it easier to train him. Because, you know, he was tough to train. So, you know, he gave him the tranquilizers, and he became so obstinate and so cantankerous. He would start lashing out at the pony, and he just refused to train until he was ready. And sometimes he'd be, like, jogging on the outside fence, and he'd just, like, dart across the track to the inside fence. And they were, like, scared that he was going to get somebody hurt or kill some other horse. He was just doing all these kind of weird things. But he had to have a workout before he left for Belmont. So they brought him out to the track for a workout, and it literally took him 45 minutes on the track. They could not get him to train, and McCarron was working him. And McCarron was kicking him in the belly and pushing, and the more he did it, the more obstinate the horse became, and he just wouldn't train. And they just said, let him stay out there, and see what happens. And he was on the track for 45 minutes. And then out of nowhere, and McCarron wasn't even expecting it, out of nowhere, he just took off. He just started working. He just broke off. And he wound up working a mile in 1:35.3. So, I mean, it was unbelievable. So, anyway, so when they finally shipped him to Belmont, and I, you know, I was there. I watched him. I watched him arrive at the barn, and he got off the van, and he was all dappled out and just absolutely gorgeous. And they brought him out to graze. And I'll never forget. He's standing there like a statue, staring at the grandstand, listening to Tom Durkin's call, which is kind of appropriate considering that Tom Durkin would have one of the greatest calls of his life, calling his race. But he was just staring at it. He can hear Durkin's call because Shug's barn, you know, is not that far from the track. And so the next day, this was on the Saturday. This was the Saturday before the Breeders' Cup. I'm trying to get all this stuff in my head here. And I remember the next day, you know, Jay took him to the track and kept his fingers crossed. And he did it again. I watched him. He went on the backstretch and he wheeled and dashed across right across the entire track. He went from the inside rail to the outside rail, and horses are checking and stopping. And it was like, oh my God, you know, this horse is out of his mind. And then that night, Jay went out to buy a bottle of vodka to give the horse, because there was an old time remedy from the old time trainers that if you wanted to settle the horse down, you gave him vodka. So, but there was no stores were open, so he couldn't get the vodka. So he decided, you know, he's going to change the horse's schedule around, and he sent them out, you know, before the break, you know, when it wasn't much, not much traffic around. And, you know, he was just doing all these weird things. And I remember Jay standing there, and when he came back, Jay told the rider, he says, turn him around and send him the other way. He says, I'm either going to confuse him or I'm going to confuse myself. But he tried something different. And it seemed to, it seemed to work. And Shug had an exercise rider named Pam York, I remember, and she had a pony named Andy. And they tried, well, let's try that. Let's take him out with Andy. And he really got along well with Andy. And he just actually calmed down. And each day, you could see his gallops were getting stronger. He didn't do any antics at all. He was absolutely tearing over the racetrack. He looked great. And during the week, like you were mentioning earlier with Dick, the Dolphin makes the announcement that Saki was going to run in the Classic in Fantastic Light. Fantastic Light had worked on the dirt and worked really, really well. And everyone was convinced that Fantastic Light was going to go in the Classic. And Saki was coming off a six-length victory in the Arc, which is like unheard of. And he had turf breeding. So why would you possibly run him on the dirt? You run Fantastic Light, who had worked on the dirt and had American breeding. And they make the announcement that Fantastic Light was going to go in the turf and Saki was going to go in the dirt. You know, and everybody was like totally shocked. So I'll never forget, you know, going to the track, you know, covering the race, obviously. And, you know, going to the track on Breeders' Cup Day was like, you talk about surreal. I mean, you go to the track and all you see around there is police dogs was searching just random automobiles, you know, entering the track, you know, coming into the parking lot, and the police dogs are searching their cars. You go to the track, and there were soldiers stationed all through Belmont Park,
yep.
And some of them had AKA assault rifles up on the roof. There were snipers.
Yep. Yes, they were.
You know, we're up on the roof watching the crowd. They had high-powered binoculars. I mean, really, the scene was surreal. And then I remember they had their big opening ceremonies where they had all the jockeys. They were accompanied by the New York police and the fire department, and they all lined up and they were holding a flag, you know, of different countries, you know, all the different jockeys from the Breeders' Cup. They each were holding a flag of their own country, and I remember it was a very emotional national anthem sung by this guy from the New York Police Department. And they had a bagpipe rendition of Amazing Grace. I mean, it was just an unbelievable day. And then by the time the Classic comes around, and this is why Tom Durkin's call, which I understand we'll be listening to, when you hear him say Tisnow wins for America, it wasn't just that Tisnow had won this race and because of 9/11. People forget that going into that race, the Europeans had won the previous three races. Banks Hill had won the Philomere Turf for France, and then Johannesburg beats the best 2-year-olds in the country.
That's right.
In the juvenile for Ireland, And then Fantastic Lives, who was supposed to go in the Classic, wins the turf for England, for Godolphin. And Coolmore runs second with a horse called Milan, who was flying at the end. So, I mean, this is like the most ignominious ending you can imagine for America. You know, and then, you know, you watch the race, and, you know, you're watching it, and then all of a sudden you see Saki ranging up on the outside, and Albert the Great is running a great race.
He ran huge.
Yeah, he was coming off a terrible race. He had run a poor race last time out, but he was running his heart out here. And Tiznow was trying to get by him and trying and trying. All of a sudden, Saki comes rolling up on the outside. Galileo was in that race. It was unbelievable. And he turned into the stretch, and Saki gets the lead. He opens up like a half a length. And Tiznow was like in third. And he's like going absolutely nowhere. And and that's it. You say, oh, my God, you know, what kind of Breeders' Cup is this going to be? Now, the Europeans are going to win the last four races? And to be won by a Godolphin horse owned by Arabs, you know, it was like, oh, my God, this is like, you know, the worst nightmare for America to lose the last four Breeders' Cup races, including two on the dirt, including the Classic. And that's what I was talking about earlier. And everybody thought, even Michael Cooper was up in the stands, and he's just saying, you know, just run on. Just show him you got some heart. He knew he was beaten. And McCarron just said, you know, I have no choice. I got to try something. And he reaches back and he hits Tiznow left-handed. And you can see him surge. And he just surges and sticks his nose right in front of the wire. And I'm watching it in the tunnel, you know, on the TV screen, you know, at the end of the tunnel. And I go running down there. And the first person I see is Tom Albertrani, who basically was training, you know, the Godolphin horses at the time. Coming from Europe, Tom was the even though Saipan Saro was a listed trainer, you know, Tom was doing, you know, a lot of the training. And Tom is all excited. He goes, I think we won. And I said, oh, I don't think so.
No.
I didn't know how to tell him he didn't win, because I could tell from watching it on TV that Tiznow had gotten his nose in front. You know, Tom was like all excited that they had won. And I tell you, when the Tiznow's number went up, it was like, so emotional. It was so unbelievable. And I remember one of the great quotes, by the way, is that we were talking to Frankie Dettori afterwards. We got off of Saki. And he was just amazed. He said, Saki, you know, to come back in 3 weeks after winning the Arc and run a race like that. He says, Saki ran an unbelievable race. He says, and I remember this quote. He says, but Tiznow has the neck of a dinosaur. I thought that was a great great quote. I mean, that was him. And it was, I tell you, it was just so emotional. And then going back to the barn after the race was just emotional going back there. You know, there's hardly anybody there. It was just an unbelievable day of racing, and the whole time of racing them. You know, they thought they might not be able to run the Breeders' Cup that year.
Right. People forget that.
They weren't going to come.
Yep.
It was Coolmore that said,
yep,
you know, well, no, we're going to come. We're coming. They came with like a whole plane load of horses. I mean, they had a lot of horses. They brought everybody, and including Galileo, who I think was insured for like $65 million coming in or something like that. So it was just such a surreal day, and it just added, and I remember going back there, you know, Michael Cooper was like, you know, and Jay and Sandy, and they were so emotional about it. I mean, Sandy was in tears. I mean, it was really one of the greatest endings for any day and any career that I've ever seen. And, you know, you're always going to remember Tiznow for all of this, and how much it transcended the sport, you know, and how much it blended into the whole 9/11 horror, and just unbelievable. You know, and listen, you wind up having a great stud career. You know, sired a whole bunch of really, really good horses. I'll tell you one thing, by the way, if you're looking for an exacto in this year's Breeders' Cup Classic, how about the Tis the Law, Tom's the Tot? Tis the Law is out of a Tiznow mare, and Tom's the Tot is out of a James Causeway mare.
Well, that's one of those serendipitous potentials.
It happens. So I mean that's I'm sure there's more, but I mean that's basically, you know, Tisnow's career is, I'm running it through my through my head, you know, starting coming back from basically on the verge of retirement with that horrible back problem.
Amazing.
And then refusing to train and becoming cantankerous and then getting beat in those two races where he just wasn't the same. He just had no enthusiasm. He had just lost his energy. And then just seeing him arrive that day and how grand he looked, and then watching him improve day after day after he nearly killed everybody on the racetrack. Just one thing after another. And then to be part of that day and covering the classic. Boy, did I love writing that story! I'll tell you, you know, there were a lot of stories that I've written, and there were several that you always remember, you know, and this one is right up there at the top, right along with Mucho Macho Man's classic, which is a story in itself. But I mean, this was just unbelievable. Like I said, the whole thing was just surreal, and I wish him, I wish him the best in retirement. I hope he lives a happy life, and I doubt Winstar will let him go, but boy, I'd love to see him at Old Friends.
Winstar, definitely.
Sure, we'll pension him there. By the way, let me say, after he retired, by the way, I went to Winstar to visit him. And now Winstar's got like 40 stallions now. So I went to Tisnow. Tisnow was one of two stallions that Winstar had. They had Tisnow and they had Distorted Humor. Who would wind up siring the Kentucky Derby winner. But, you know, they started out with just those two stallions.
Amazing.
Now they're like one of the, you know, big, you know, stallion,
it's like 40.
Stallion factories in Kentucky. But, yeah, a lot of great times with Tisnow. He's just, and to be around him, by the way, what a gorgeous, massive, magnificent horse he was to be around. So, hopefully, Winstar will have him out running around the paddock, and one of these days, whenever the world gets back to normal, we'll be able to go out and see him again.
Well, before we listen to the 2001 Breeders' Cup, a few elements to lead up. It was a different era because it was a 10-race card. There was not, and of course, it was one day of Breeders' Cup action, and even early. In the day before the Cup races started, Graham Hall was winning the Stuyvesant. Yanaguska won the Sport Page. What's become of the Sport Page, by the way?
Good question. It used to be a good race.
Yeah, that just occurs to me if they've changed that or if it's disappeared completely. But then the Breeders' Cup started, and this was the era when the Distaff was many times would lead off. And Unbridled the Lane. For Dallas Stewart, from off the pace, of course, with Pat Day, and upsets Spain. Although Spain was not the favorite, trying to win back-to-back distaffs, the favorite actually was Flute. And that's a story.
Well, one of my all-time favorites. God, I loved her. What a sweetheart she was. Bobby Frankel, I would say, loved her more than any horse she ever trained. I actually have videotape of Frankel with her kissing her and nuzzling her. And he absolutely fell in love with Flute, you know. And she wound up winning the Oaks, she wound up winning the Alabama, and then she just lost a couple of races. She ran a good race, I think it was in the Beldame, but she didn't run well in the Distaff.
Well, that, of course, at that point, Bobby was still winless in the Cup. That would change later in the card, but he was still looking for that breakthrough. He had lost 30-something straight, and Flute, you would think, at 6-5 was going to be a big chance. Mm-hmm. The second was the Juvenile Fillies, and you had another price, and Tempura wins the AP Indy.
The Dolphin too, right?
Yes, it was for Owen Hardy.
Oh, I didn't know.
12-1
Trainer, right?
Yep. And you may forget, I had forgotten this. Imperial Gesture was second, so they
that's
ran
another,
1-2.
Another Godolphin horse, isn't it?
Both Owen Hardy 1-2, 54-1. 54-1.
Yeah, and, I mean, Godolphin was on the verge of having a monster day.
Well, and this is part of the big story of the day, because Frankel had the favorite here with you at a tick under even money. Right. So she gets beat. She's off the board. Now we get to the mile, and Val Royal for David Milch. And I remember well. And Julio Canani, what a surprise. 5-1, and Forbidden Apple is second. This for Clement and Mr. Appleton, your favorite. They had real trouble making a favorite here, but it was Irish Prize, who I barely remember was the favorite.
I always loved Appleton Silks, the white silks with the red apple.
That's right. Well, that gets us to the sprint. And at just under 10-1... Bobby Frankel gets off the Breeders' Cup Schneid with Squirtle Squirt.
Yeah, I got to interject one second, by the way. That's something, you know, Frankel, they turned him over to Frankel. He was a new horse. And I remember I was visiting Frankel's barn at Saratoga. And we're going here, and he said, I just got this horse. And we came over, he showed me Squirtle Squirt. And he said, I'm going to win the Breeders' Cup Sprint with this horse. I said, yeah, okay, Bobby. Sounds like a typical Bobby Frankel line. You know, I'm just going to say that. But he was like emphatic. He said, I'm telling you, I'm going to win the Breeders' Cup Sprint with this horse.
Well,
I thought that was kind of funny.
You want to listen to a lineup. There's a 14-horse field, and the favorite was the defending winner, Kona Gold, who had run in the previous four and had gone from fourth to third to second to first. And he ends up off the board. But listen to this sprint lineup, and this is what's so crazy about what's happened to the sprint. Squirtle Squirt was first. Extra Heat was second.
Mm-hmm.
Caller One was third.
And Caller One, by the way, when Tisnow arrived, two horses got off the van from California. One was Tisnow and the other was Caller One. He was the first off the van, and then Tisnow got off the van right after him.
Swept Overboard was fourth.
Oh, God. He was a really good horse. Come from behind horse.
With Eddie D, and was flying at the end from dead last and gets beat about a length. Left Bank, Swept Overboard, Left Bank with Johnny.
Wow.
Delaware Township with Ibar Koa was sixth. I'm warming up. Five Star Day. Kona Gold was seventh. Five Star Day was eighth with Garrett Gomez. Peeping Tom.
Oh, my God. His name's
for Patty Reynolds.
Yes, and these are all major stakes horses.
All running sons of guns and one running bitch in Extra Heat. On and on. I mean, it's just crazy. Al Anand, who I vaguely remember, Al Anand was 10th. Mozart was 11th.
Yeah, Fast European.
With Mick Kinane. El Corridor was 12th.
El Corridor was in there.
El Corridor was 12th with Victor. He was the second choice.
You know, they had no dirt mile then, because he was like the best miler in the country.
Unbelievable. Then Bet on Sunshine, who, of course, was coming off a third the previous year for Paul McGee and was a huge third for me in the previous year with Kona Gold and Honest Lady. He's 13th.
Tough hard knocker, that horse.
With Calvin Burrell, and Mig was last on Hook and Ladder.
Oh, God. That's a hell of a field.
Is that a field or what?
Wow. Any one of those horses could have won that race. I don't think it would have been a shot.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So Bobby gets his elusive win, and you mentioned earlier that Banks Hill wins the Filly and Mare Turf over Spook Express, the excellent South African, Andre Favre runs 1-2 in there. Then comes, as you mentioned, the shocking Johannesburg win. But, you know, what's interesting, you know, Officer was nowhere in there. He ends up.
Officer, they thought was a super horse. They thought he was like the next super horse, remember?
He was fifth. He was fifth, beating three, four lengths.
Before, by the way, he won. He was like eased up the last eighth of a mile. And I remember saying, I don't like that. He's, you know, the horse has never, ever been asked to run. And I said, somebody's going to look that horse in the eye, and he's not going to know what to do. And that's exactly what happened. He had to lead at the quarter pole, and I forget, there was another really good horse that looked him in the eye, and he just chucked it. I mean, he had never, ever been asked to run. And then Johannesburg comes flying out of nowhere.
Johannesburg with Kane, and Repent was second at 42-1.
Yeah, he turned out to be a good horse, too.
Absolutely. Siphonic third, Publication Officer, French Assault, Came Home, Sarland, Ibn Al-Hatame, wow. It's All in the Chase, Jumpstart, and Essence of Dubai. This was not a vintage juvenile. Good field, not the greatest ever. Fantastic yeah. Light wins the turf over Milan.
Yeah, Milan was flying at the end to be second.
Yep.
And I said, oh, God, I said, this is not going to be good for America, that's for sure. And the thing is, you forget, by the way, the big American horse that year going into the Classic was Aptitude, who had won the Jockey Club Gold Cup by 8 lengths. And I remember after the race, I went back to the barn with Bobby, and I thought Bobby was going to be ecstatic. He said, you know, you win the Jockey Club, and Bobby was, like, so ticked off. He said, that's it. He said, we blew it. I said, well, what are you talking about? Because, you know, Bobby was into Ragusa numbers. And he said, oh, forget about it. He's going to bounce like hell in the Breeders' Cup now. He just, you know, he just went too fast. He wins by 8 lengths. And then I was with him when they took the entries. And the Aptitude draws like post 14. And I remember Bobby just walked out of the room. He said, that's it. Race is over. We're done.
He was actually in the 12. But,
I knew he had an outside post.
He went off the favorite. They made him.
Yeah, no, he was the big American horse in the race, and he did make a big run on the turn, very wide run, and he couldn't sustain it.
With Bailey, I can't remember. It's funny. I've got my notes. I happen to have note cards with my. That I took with me to the track, my sort of prep work and my bet structures and what I was thinking. I cannot remember who I bet in here and who I liked. I know that I didn't, certainly the year before, I did not like Tisnow and had Tisnow on, you know, nowhere on my tickets. But my day was made earlier in the first half of the card, but.
Excuse me 1 second. I remember when I was at the barn when I was talking to Jay, and I told him, I said, Jay, buddy, you realize that no California bred has ever won the Classic. And I remember Jay saying, oh, okay, well, we'll just pack them up and send them home tomorrow. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. We're not going to run. Tisnow and Saki, Albert the Great, Macho Uno, Guided Tour, Galileo. It's interesting. Saki and Galileo come to mind, but Black Minnalouche was coming
from
Europe, too.
Yeah, that's another. Aiden O'Brien had two horses in there.
Yep.
He was more of a miler that they were trying to stretch out. He was a really good miler. And they were stretching him out, and you know he didn't do too much. I remember Galileo was stuck down on the rail the whole race, by the way, and never really fired. But yeah, everybody was shocked. Galileo, you know, was one of the great horses, you know, in modern times. There, you know, who knew it was going to become the most prolific sire we've ever seen. But he didn't do much. But I mean, to have Saki, by the way, look. I remember watching him gallop one morning. I said, oh, my God, look at this horse. His neck was arched, and he just looked fantastic. But, I mean, to have all these classic winners in there, I mean, between Saki and Galileo, and they'd won, like, every major race in Europe. But, I mean, Saki had that race won. He's just on the outside. He just had all the momentum. And, you know, it's not like, you know, a horse gets the lead. But, I mean, Albert the Great was hanging tough, but, you know, you could see he wasn't going to win. And Tisnow just wasn't going anywhere. He was hanging in there, but he didn't have anything. Until McCarron hit him that one time, just once, and that's all it took, that one left-handed whip, and boom.
Let's listen to one of the really iconic calls in Breeders' Cup history and racing history, Tom Durkin, the 2001 Breeders' Cup Classic, Tisnow, Saki, and more.
ready for the start of the Classic. And they're off! To the cheers of the crowd and guided tour breaks alertly with Orientate. Albert the Great is gunned to the lead. That's Albert the Great. Ore Chavez puts him in front, but Pat Day and Orientate are going to take the fight to him. And those two hook up in a speed duel in the first furlong here. Tiz now not far behind. He's running third in the early going. Guided Tour drops back to run along in fourth. Galileo only five lengths from the lead. He's fifth. The arc winner, Saki, is sixth on the outside. And the favorite, Aptitude, is now running in seventh. Macho Uno bulls his way through from eighth now. Black Benelouche's ninth. Include is down toward the inside, and he's now tenth. Freedom Crest, Gander, who's well in hand, and at the back of the pack is long shot of Fleet Dancer. The quarter went in 23 1/5 seconds, a grueling pace here. An into the wind half of 47 seconds flat. Albert the Great grinding it out on a short lead now. Orientate couldn't stay with him. There goes Guided Tour, who splits horses decisively with five furlongs to go. And on the outside, the daunting presence of a horse of the year. Tiz now, and he's right there just off the pace fourth. Saki and Galileo right there and behind the lead. Macho Uno's in the thick of it as Aptitude begins to roll here with 3.5 furlongs to go in the Classic, and it is Albert the Great blazing the way. Tiz now looms in second. Saki is there on the outside. Guided Tour fights on. Galileo's under a heavy drive. He's still 6 lengths behind. Include will put his run through on the rail. Aptitude is taken wide by Gander, and the field turns for home. Here comes the arc winner, Saki, and he storms to the lead. Saki in narrow lead, and Tiz now is battling on the American Horse of the Year, and the arc winner are heads apart with a furlong to go in the Classic. On the outside, Saki, Tiz now fights on. Here's the winner, desperately close. Tiz now wins it for America, beating Saki.
I just got goosebumps listening to it.
Yeah, it really, no matter how many times you've seen it.
Nobody calls a race like Tom. I mean, that was such a perfect call. I mean, he just picked everything. And just as you could note from his voice in the Birdstone Belmont Stakes, this was like the total opposite. You can feel the excitement in his voice when he's screaming, and he goes, "Tiz now wins it for America." I mean, it was so appropriate. I mean, to win for America, yeah, because of 9/11, because of the Europeans are about to dominate the Breeders' Cup. I mean, it was just, you can't make this stuff up. It was so great.
Well, and
I can't believe it was almost 20 years ago, though. Oh, my God.
Well, next year we'll get, there'll be a lot of 20-year reminiscence on that front. There's something, too, about this that really works, is that coda, post-wire. You know, there's occasions where, the trail off after the call doesn't always, you know, finish as succinctly and tying it up, but it really does there. As Tom grasps the enormity of the moment, and how this race is going to resonate in racing history and Breeders' Cup history, and so he puts a perfect bow on the thing to tie it up. It's fabulous.
And in some crazy way too, by the way, is that what Tiz now did just almost exemplified the courage and tenacity of the country, and especially New York City, and how they were reacting to 9/11 with everybody just, helping out, and all the firefighters and the police and everything, and just how the whole city just bonded together and just to get over this. And it was just in some crazy way, this was such an appropriate finish for that, because, I mean, it just shows you, how resolute a horse could be, how resolute the city could be, how people can be. And, you know, I know it's trivial to tie in a horse race to what happened in 9/11, but speaking from a horse racing standpoint, you know, that's where the concentration was. That's what our world was. You know, my world was horse racing. So to equate it to that was just natural for me.
No, it was pretty special, and being there, and you know, it is notable. I mean, we've been waiting obviously for you know, a Breeders' Cup to come back to Belmont Park.
I don't get it. I don't know if just NYRA doesn't want it, or maybe it's just too much.
To an extent, there's also, you know, there's also the
they lose control. You know, I don't know if NYRA wants to lose control of the event, because you just got to basically turn it over to the Breeders' Cup, and I don't know if the Breeders' Cup is putting the muzzle on this. I don't know. I have no idea, but I mean, it's been a long time. It's 15 years now.
Easily. 2005, right? Which was
St.
the one?
St. William.
Yes.
That was with Belmont Breeders' Cup.
And is my memory faulty, or was it so miserably cold that...
Oh, my God, was it ever cold. I got to tell you about it. I brought John and Mandy there, and, you know, I got seats for them, box seats. So they would go out and watch a race, and as soon as the race was over, they'd run in and go to the bar.
Yeah, yeah.
Have a drink to warm up. You know, they would have some kind of drink, and they spent the whole day at the bar in between races trying to warm up. It was brutal, especially in the front side.
Yes.
You know, the front side tends to be like 20 degrees colder than the back side. I mean, from the paddock area.
Yeah.
But, oh, my God, was that a cold day. That was really, it was nice out, but it was so, so cold.
It was bone chilling. I mean, it was going, you know, it was that kind of cold that really got into you. And I remember afterward, there was the after parties in the tent. I don't know if you remember,
I remember the after parties in the tent.
And it took, I mean, a stomping of the feet to try to warm yourself up, because it was freezing in there. And I don't know if you remember this, but the Sopranos were all there. The cast of the Sopranos.
I remember that. Yeah, and we're there, I remember.
Yeah, everybody was there, it seemed. So it made it fun. I mean, little did we know that was going to be the last time. But it was a really tough day physically. And you know, you think back to 90, and I made reference earlier this morning too. I mean, which was as difficult a day at a racetrack that anyone will ever attend.
That was unbelievable. But I got to tell you one just quick thing. By the way, I got to the track that morning. In 90, and I'm driving to the track, and I'm listening to the radio, and on the sports report, it says that Unbridled had been scratched from the Classic. I said, oh no, damn! I said, oh, you know, and I wasn't covering the Classic that year. It was in 90. I was covering the Turf. I said, oh no. So I walk into the track. The first person I see is Carl Nafska. And I go over to him, I said, and Carl still remembers it to this day. I go over, I said, Carl, I'm so sorry to hear about Unbridled. I said, what happened? He goes, what are you talking about? I said, I just heard on the radio, we scratched. He goes, really? He says, I just came from the barn. He said, that's news for me. The horse is doing great. I said, I just heard it on the radio, like about 15 minutes earlier. Yeah. He said, the horse is doing great. He said, I just left him at the barn. He said, he's doing fantastic.
That's funny. And
he beat the European. You remember the European he beat in that race?
Oh, gosh. Yes, I do, actually.
He had a funny name.
He's got a funny name, is right. It's All Greek to Me. Had run in the Turf right before, and Unbridled.
That was the race Piggott won.
Yes. That was special, too.
Yeah. His name was Ibn Bey.
I was going to say Ibn Bey, and then I thought for a minute it was Ibn Bey, the horse that fell over Mr. Nickerson, but it's not.
Oh,
it was,
God, no. Yeah.
It was...
I was in the sprint.
Oh my God! How can I forget him too? Anyway, just a crazy. You know, there was a parade. There was. It seemed like every single one. There was something going on at the Belmont Breeders' Cups. We had Exogenous Flip.
That was in the walkway. Horrible. They couldn't get her out. She was stuck under there.
Yes, that was horrible. Horrific.
I went back to the barn afterwards to see how she was doing. Like the next morning, I went back and they said, "Oh, she's doing fine." And then she started dying.
No, she had a concussion, and there was brain swelling, over the next three or four days.
They thought she was doing okay, and then it just hit her. But oh, what a horrible sight that was! Her getting stuck under that by the rail there. Oh,
yep.
God, it was horrible.
That was 2001.
Yeah. The thing is that all these horrible things happened at Belmont. Ruffian,
well,
Gopher One, Exogenous, Prairie Bayou in the Belmont Stakes. I mean, even going way back, by the way, that when horses really never broke down. In the Belmont Stakes, Black Hills in Sword Dances Belmont, when Eddie O'Carroll almost drowned in the puddle. It was a sloppy track, and he fell face down, got knocked unconscious, and he was, fortunately, somebody was there to get his head out of the puddle. That was at Belmont Park, when Black Hills broke down in the Belmont Stakes. And O'Carroll, like I said, O'Carroll almost drowned in a puddle. I mean, I don't know what it is with Belmont Park, but all these horrific things just have happened there over the years.
It's true. You have any?
That's a Gopher One, by the way. I almost left. I said I don't ever want to come back again. I was so sickened by it. It was right in front of me, and I could. It's just like it was again. You talk about surreal. I said, "Oh my God, what happened?" I thought she like tripped. You know, I said, well, "What happened?" And I had to cover the next. I had to cover the turf the next race. I said, "Oh, I just want to get out of here."
Now I'm mentioning Mr. Nickerson and the sadness associated with that, but the other part of that, you had Dejour jump the shadow, which opened the door for Safely Kept. I mean, it's just it's
right.
Since
that was
a,
weird.
That was a
that
crazy,
was really bizarre. He had that
crazy thing.
He jumped it twice.
Yeah, twice.
Right, you can see the shadow from the roof coming right down where he was, and he just jumped right over it, and then he jumps it again, and she just sticks her neck in front to beat him. He had that race won. Ugh, wacky, weird things.
Yeah, that was that. That sticks in my mind. Meadow Star winning that day. I don't know if people remember. Right, she won the juvenile fillies.
Yeah, she looked like she was going to be absolutely brilliant, and. She wound up winning the Mother Goose the following year. I mean, she was a good...
It's one of the greatest moments in Belmont Park history. The mother of all gooses.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
Pretty funny.
That was a call I can...
Yeah.
On her, and my buddy Rob Wiley was the, a bloodstock agent, advisor, and he did all his pedigrees and everything.
I'll tell you the one I don't remember as well, because since we're on this topic, I don't have as vivid a memory of 95, of Cigar's year, and what went on. Yeah, I don't. I think I was living in Montreal at that time, and I don't. Or no, where was I living? 90. I was living in Montreal, and I don't think I made it. I'm going to say I did not make it down for 95. I do not remember being there.
That was a bleak. It was a bleak day. I mean, Julie Cronin just got beat in the sprint on Mr. Greeley. Got beat by a filly that Joanne Noor owned. Filly just got up to beat her. That was a very
Desert Stormer.
Desert Stormer, right? It was a bleak. That was a bleak day. Classic Field was, you know, was not the greatest field. I mean, it was just an okay field. It wasn't the greatest. You know, it was good that it ended, you know, with Cigar winning.
I'm having trouble even just conjuring. I should pull out my. I do have the. Where is my Breeders' Cup? My guide. I cannot really. Who else was prominent that day? Because I don't. It's kind of an empty. Is that Unbridled Song? That would be Unbridled Song.
Yes, exactly.
Juvenile,
Unbridled
right?
Song, right, of course.
Yeah, that
right,
I. That,
yeah, Unbridled Song. Yeah, Unbridled Song just got up and.
You know,
and then,
you
and
know
then
what?
I think what do you call it was that the I think My Flag was in the
My Flag, man, that's got to be about right about that time.
It was in the Juvenile Fillies that year, and what was the Lucas had the big horse in there that was ridden by I'm drawing a blank here. I tell you, the mind goes. You know, the female jockey that does TV now. I know her really well. I can't think of her name.
Donna Brothers?
I hope she's not listening.
Donna Brothers.
Donna Brothers, God. I keep thinking, you know, because her name wasn't Brothers back then.
Barton.
You know,
Donna Barton
back then, yeah. But she almost won that race, and she just got beaten in the photo.
You know, and if it's My Flag's year, that means inside information. And here's my man Marty. Here's my man Marty Shapiro. Marty confirming inside information won the distaff because that
14 lengths.
Ran that crazy race. And Heavenly Prize. Shug has talked about that on the show. I can't remember if one of them or the other passed, and we talked about her, and we talked about that.
Heavenly Prize had been the big filly in the barn. I mean, they're both in the Hall of Fame. But,
yeah.
I mean, she just absolutely, inside information, just absolutely, she just loved the off track. And, you know, Shug had a lot of good fillies in those days.
Still does.
Yeah, that's true.
Still does. That hasn't changed. I tell you what, though, that was a nice field because, in addition to the Phipps pair, Inside Information, Heavenly Prize, because I pulled up the chart, Lakeway was third. Serena's Song was fifth.
Wow. Yeah, some good fillies around those days.
And the late Gary Jones had Forested finished fourth in there at 133-1.
Really? Wow.
With Renee Douglas. Yeah.
Yeah, that's that Breeders' Cup's starting to come back now. Yeah, it was one of those Breeders' Cups that you just don't remember that well. I mean, I covered the Classic that year for Daily Racing Form, but I just, you know, it was just, like I said, it was just such a miserable day on a bad track, and you know, I just didn't remember a lot. But now that you mention, of course, yeah, of course. Yeah, you know, Bridal Song, Inside Information.
This was Northern Spurs turf.
That's right. Yeah, he loved the soft turf too. That's right.
They called the turf soft too. I'm looking at the chart. They called it soft. Sadler's Wells and Ron McAnally for Mr. Sella.
Yeah. The thing is, once you start mentioning horses, they'll come back. You know, or the whole day starts coming back now. But that sprint is an underrated race, by the way. You've all watched that sprint in with Mr. Greeley and Desert Stormer. That was a tremendous race.
I'll pull that up.
That was the race, by the way. Mike Martin. Mike Martin had gone down to the airport to shoot the horses coming in from California. And he was there, and he took pictures of Desert Stormer coming off the plane. And Joanne Noor was there. And she said, "Oh, can I get some of those pictures?" Well, they turned out to become a couple.
That's how they met? That's where they met? Oh, that's great.
They met at the airport when Mick was shooting the horses coming in from California, coming off the plane.
Wow, that's funny.
And Joanne Noor was there and just asked him, for pictures, and they just stuck up. And, if you know Mick, by the way, he had like 8,000 girlfriends at the time, And I remember when he started getting serious with Joanne, I said, "Yeah, right, okay, fine." I said, "How long is that going to last?" And it lasted for years and years. And
yes, it did.
He had an absolutely phenomenal relationship, and she really settled him down quite a bit. Mick was quite the ladies' man. But that's how they met. They met at the airport, at that Breeders' Cup.
Now, that Desert Stormer over Mr. Greeley, they were tight finish, and coming late on the scene was Lita Justice with Nakatani.
Yeah.
Not surprising with Robbie Davis. And Friendly Lover. Friendly Lover was fifth. Wow. Our Emblem. Our Emblem sixth. You and I was in there. Golden Gear. I liked Golden Gear.
Yeah, it was a good,
nice horse.
You go back, you start hearing those feels, and like I said, everything starts coming back, and you can start envisioning the race.
The mile, looking at the mile too, Ridgewood Pearl.
Another filly. Another filly.
Indian Ridge Mare. She was three. She was a 3-year old too.
Big, strong, powerful filly. I remember.
How about that? Over Fastness, Sayadati, Dove Hunt, Savinio, Soviet Line, Four Stars All Star.
Four Stars All Star, the first American trained horse ever to win a European Classic.
That's right. That's it. Then the Juvenile, which we mentioned. Juvenile, this is a pretty good Juvenile with Unbridled Song, Hennessy, Editor's Note, Honor and Glory, Diligence, Winter Quarters.
That's who Diana was riding. Diana was riding.
Hennessy. Yeah. Hennessy beating the neck at 7-1.
Yeah. And Brother Song loved the slop. Loved it.
D. Wayne finished second, third, and fourth.
That's typical.
Second, third, and fourth. Hennessy, Editor's Note, Honor and Glory.
It's first, second, and third.
Yeah.
Breeders' Cup memories.
That's pretty funny. Well, listen, it's actually, we're just happy. We're only talking about Tiznow's retirement from his stud career. He's 23. Let him live another decade and enjoy himself without any demands on him.
Yeah, I hope I get a chance to see him again. Joan and I were there a couple of years ago. A bunch of gals from Windstar were out there with us, and they brought him out. We're taking pictures with him. He still looks absolutely phenomenal. Still dappled and just a magnificent horse. He had that unbelievable face, which I actually sort of a just slightly smaller version than Tiz the Lord's, because his blaze looked like if you look at it, it looked like a tornado. I always remember that. He was just so striking. He had the white ankles. Last time I saw him, he still looked great. Still looked absolutely fantastic.
I haven't. That's one thing I have not. I don't get to do that as often as I'd like. I got to go to the farms and see.
Oh God, you should. I mean, you remember all these horses, and just to see them now, it just brings back so many memories when you see them now. But I mean, you're in Kentucky enough. You go down to the Derby so far in advance. Take a trip. Take a trip to. To Lexington. I remember one year, I think it was 2011. I was covering the Breeders' Cup at Churchill, and me and Ernie Munich and Richie Migliori drove from Louisville to Lexington to go see. How about this for a double in one day? We went to two farms that day. The first one to see Zenyatta, and the second one to see Rachel Alexandra. So I have to tell you how special that was. I mean, it's great. I mean, the thing is, it breaks it up, too. If you're in Louisville, by the way, you know, it's an hour and a half drive or so at the most.
Yeah.
You know, you hop in your car after you do the show in the morning, you hop in your car and go visit some of your favorite horses. And bring back a lot of memories.
True. You're right. We should. We should do it. I went to Edina a few years ago. That was fun. Eric Hamelbeck had me out to Edina. And
But Edina is like in the middle of absolutely nowhere.
Yes.
So you got to go through Paris, and then you got to go. You go another 10 miles past Paris. Where the heck am I already?
Yeah.
But it's a beautiful farm, but it's worth to go there to see this. You know what? To see Ghost Zapper and Awesome Again and Mucho Macho Man. They got a lot of interesting stallions there.
They got the stallions.
I had a big incident at Edina Springs. I saw my first and only ever coyote.
Really? Tina and I saw a coyote the other day.
He was running right in front of the car.
We got them left and right up here. There's coyotes. There's coyote dog. What they call the coy dogs. Everybody seems to be raising chickens suddenly. They're everywhere you look, there's chickens. So you got chickens running around loose. You're gonna get coyotes.
That's an invitation to coyotes
and foxes. Fox as well. Ton of fox. They're all over the place. Steve, this was fabulous.
A lot of reminiscing.
Big time.
What are you doing tonight?
Tina's got something. We have to go up toward Lake George. She has to pick up a baby. She ordered something for the baby. For the baby, because we're going to Rochester.
I hear the Eagles are holding tryouts for every position.
Yeah, you better keep your head down because you're gonna be it's gonna be a very unpleasant couple of months for you.
No, listen. I think they got a good shot to win. I mean, it has nothing against them. I give them all the credit in the world. I don't know. They either have the worst trainers or they're cursed. I mean, they have no starters left. They have like two or three starters. And, you know, what they're doing, they bring up these guys from the practice squad, Boston Scott and Greg Ward and this guy Perkins last year. And this year, this Travis Fogelum comes out of nowhere, this Old Dominion walk-on who looks like the next Randy Morse. And
he's terrific.
John Hightower. I mean, I give him...
Well, he's a draft.
I give the Eagles all the credit in the world for hanging in there and... What they did last year with all these unknown guys, they all getting hurt. Everybody, the whole team is hurt. I've never seen anything like it in my life.
Well, they're gonna be fine. I forgot. I didn't realize you meant late night viewing for the game because we're going to Rochester for the weekend to see the baby. It's been a month. So
well,
we gotta go
see
the baby.
Precedence over everything.
Yes, it does. We got to go see the baby.
I think it's gonna be a great. It'll be a great game. At least they get Deshaun Jackson back tonight, so that'll be good. But I feel sorry for him. The whole team is out. They lost both tight ends. They lose every single of the one of their wide receivers. Their whole offensive line is gone. I mean, my goodness. I give them all the credit in the world. They're right there. They should. I thought they were going to pull out a miracle last week.
They came the way they came back. I thought was really credible, and it.
I give them a lot more credit than I give the Cowboys, who can't stop a nosebleed. I mean, their defense is not if Dak Prescott is gone, but God, they need to improve their defense. That Eastern Division is just absolutely a mess.
it is a little, you know, for those of us that are, you know, of an age that recall when the NFC East was the most fearsome, you know, division in the game, it is a little difficult to see what's going on right now.
No,
but that's
it's
cyclical.
Really
that stuff, nah, that stuff's cyclical. That'll they'll swing back around.
Yeah. I assume when, you know, they get Lane Johnson back, you know, for God knows how long, he gets hurt every 5 minutes. But, you know, I'm hoping when, you know, Alshon Jeffery's supposed to come back in the next few weeks if they get, you know, and then they lose Zach Ertz and Dallas Goedert. I mean, if they get these guys back, if they're in contention at the end of the year,
well, exactly.
You know, I think they can pull off what they did last year.
Exactly. So, you know, in the meantime, Wentz is playing great, and I've got no concerns. I even when things a couple of weeks ago looked fairly bleak, I wasn't.
Have you been watching this Travis Fulgham?
Oh, it's amazing! It's a wonderful story too.
Where did this guy come from? I mean, he had been on two other teams that cut him. He was a walk on an Old Dominion, and I'm telling you, he's like Randy Moss. I mean, this guy's like all over the place. It's incredible where they come up with these guys.
Well,
out of nowhere.
His story is pretty cool because he, you know, parents were in the military and were in the diplomatic corps, and so he didn't really get to the game until late in his high school year, and you know, at ODU, and what he is, you know, is one of these, you know, fire high targets. You just throw the ball at the highest arc,
exactly. He gets up
and he'll
it's like
exactly.
He's doing his whole life. I'm telling you, he's like, he looks like Randy Moss.
Now, for those of us, we'll think more along the Harold Carmichael, you know, Charles Young, what was called the Fire High Gang, Zimmerman,
yeah.
Don Zimmerman.
Not quite as tall as Harold Carmichael, but
no, he goes up and he's going to out.
He knows how to high point it. I'll tell you that.
Yes, exactly.
You know, he's been doing his whole life. I said, how the hell did he get cut by two teams?
It's a funny game. In fact, Johnny and I and Will Schwartz were tag texting and talking about it a couple of weeks ago, and it's very strange. And, you know, it's also, listen, it's no different in some ways than you know, horses that get claimed and were either running, you know, running in the wrong spots or wrong surface, wrong distances, and you know, the formula.
Maximum security, right?
Well,
comes out of nowhere.
Well, more like, you know, Starship Jubilee is you know, she's
a
good example.
Very, very ordinary. Yeah, and she gets good. She just gets
well,
good at the end.
Well, in CZ Rocket, you look at what, you know, CZ Rocket, I know everybody, you know, loves to attack Peter Miller, but it with CZ Rocket, it's as simple as just turning him back to sprint distances. He was being run, they were trying to make him into something that he clearly isn't or wasn't. And now he's back sprinting and he's rock solid. I don't, you know, he's not a star, but he's rock solid because he's doing what, you know, what he's meant to do.
Yeah. Hey, listen, you know, I mean, Eagles could have very easily won that game if they didn't come up with, like, the worst two-point conversion attempt ever.
Well, they'll forget. The offensive line is a patchwork mess. So, it's too bad they didn't,
totally
should have taken
up,
a timeout.
Come back like that against a team like that, like the Ravens? I mean,
yep.
I give him credit. I mean,
I agree.
You know, I mean, what they did last year with all these unknowns. I mean, you know, I think Boston Scott is still doing well, and Greg Ward is still around. Like, I mean, he's hurt too, I think now. But
he'll be back.
We'll see what happens. I'm looking forward to tonight's game. Actually, I think it should be for a 1-4-1 team and a 1-5 team. You know, it should be interesting. And Giants remembered DeSean Jackson very well too. So,
well, I may end up. What time do these games start on Thursday? Did they start
o'clock,
late?
8 o'clock or so. It used to be like 8:20, but I think they start earlier now.
Yeah, because the those later starting things are.
It's always a fun game.
Gotten
when
hard.
Teams meet. I'm looking forward to it.
saw a lot of growing up. My first games were always Eagle Giant games because we would get tickets to see the Giants.
Listen, I went to an Eagles game a few years ago. It was the first game that Terrell Owens played for them. He caught three touchdown passes.
That's right.
Donovan McNabb. I was at that game with Dan Barslow sitting in the suite.
My first NFL games were in Yankee Stadium and in the Yale Bowl.
Mine too. My first game at Yankee Stadium when the Giants were playing. It was like in the late 50s. The Giants were playing the
Polo Grounds.
The Pittsburgh Steelers with Tom the Bomb Tracy and Bobby Lane, and the Giants got beat like 13-10, and I was crying like a baby.
Was that at the Polo Grounds or at Yankee Stadium?
No, that was the Yankee Stadium. I went to Polo Grounds many times, too, to see the old Titans play. You know, I was there. By the way. Here's something interesting. I went to a game once at the old Polo Grounds between the Titans and the Buffalo Bills where the Bills won the race. I think it was like 20-10. And Cookie Gilchrist scored every point. He scored two touchdowns. He kicked two field goals, and kicked all the extra points.
That's pretty funny. Cookie Gilchrist. Wow.
Yeah, I used to go to all those old games. You know, those were great. I went to all the early Jet games at the Shea Stadium.
Sure.
You know, I went to a Titans game, the first Titans game, and when Billy Cannon scored five touchdowns for
Billy
Houston.
Billy Cannon. Holy cow. Wow.
That's going way back.
You know, and it's funny, you mentioned Shea, and you jog my memory. We did go see the Jets. We did see the Jets. We saw a Jet-Dolphin game. By then, it had to be the 70s already, but my grandfather...
That was way afterwards.
I do remember, I'll have to ask my father, I do remember my grandfather, we go with him to the Mets all the time, but I do remember seeing I'm going to have to look at their schedule and figure out what game we saw, because it was, I can't remember if it was Earl Morrill or not Earl Morrill,
No, well, Earl Morrow, was in the early 70s. He was his team that he was his quarterback that led him to the
Super Bowl. It might have been. I mean,
he was a backup. He was the quarterback that stepped in for Unitas when the Colts had that incredible team. You know, when Namath beat him, and then he went to the Dolphins and he subbed for Greasy and
That's
got
right.
to the Super Bowl. Paul Warfield and everything, and
Zonka and Kick. That's why we went, and it's right in that wheelhouse. I remember because we actually that could have been because of Bonaconte. Nick Bonaconte was a member of our country club, Ellington Ridge.
Oh, really? Wow.
And even though that Nick lived in Springfield, Mass, or maybe in Wilbraham, but right in and around Springfield, and he was a member of our club, and was around all the time during the off season, in the summer before camp, and we might have gotten that. Might be the reason we got a chance to go. I got to ask my father about this. I hadn't thought about this in forever. Wow.
Yeah, it was great. It was great time. Great time for football. I remember going to a Jets Oakland Raiders game where Tom Flores was the quarterback for the Raiders.
And the big
running
cow.
Back was Hewlett Dixon. You remember him?
Sure, remember Hewlett Dixon.
She was like 250 pounds or something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was sort of I had a little bit of Raider interest by the way. Only because of when I got to Colgate, when I knew I was going to be going to Colgate, and you know, between Mark Van Egan and Marv Hubbard, so I, you know, took a little interest in the Raiders.
We really deviated from our.
That's all right. We're famous for that. That's been part.
I keep forgetting we're on the air.
No, they don't. Nobody.
We were just talking.
That, everybody loves it. Believe me, it's been a funny couple of days that way. We've kind of hit on.
You know, they used to have college football trading cards.
Sure, I've got some college cards.
They would just have somebody from all the different teams. I remember one of the first trading cards I ever got was Colgate. And the thing I remember about them is that the stripe on the helmet was very wide.
Yeah.
That's what I remember. I said, Colgate, wait a second, Colgate, that's toothpaste.
That's it, you bet. Austin Colgate and James B. Colgate, the Colgate family.
Yeah. All I knew was the Colgate Comedy Hour. But I remember they had college football trading cards. I'll never
sure.
forget it.
I've got some kicking around. Absolutely.
Really? Wow.
I've got those leather, those cigarette pack leathers that from colleges. I'll put a picture of those up there. I love those. I must have 75 or 80 of them.
Wow.
Leather fobs that have like pennants of colleges on them. Steve, this was fabulous. It's closing time here.
Yeah, I think I screwed up the rest of your guests. So.
No, it was fine. It was fine. Absolutely fine, because Marcus Hirsch was going to join us, but he sent me a note about 20 minutes ago apologizing, and he said, how about
tomorrow? Oh, okay. That don't feel so bad.
No. Steve Haskin and Tis Now, everybody, and, of course, secretariat.com for Steve, and earlier, Tony Black, as well as Dick Powell. Good luck if you're playing today, Thursday. Plenty of options, and weekend preview tomorrow, Maryland Million, Empire Showcase, and more, and a Triple Crown try north of the border. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you in the morning.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Our Pennsylvania breeding program was, of course, impacted by the pandemic. Now, with our country getting back to work, we'd like to again talk about our program, the best in North America. Our breeder awards will remain up to 50% for PA-sired PA breds. Owner bonuses will also stay at up to 40%. Restricted races will again be run at all three PA tracks, and PA Day at the Races will return. I'm Brian Sanfratello. For more, please visit PABred.com.